wanted to do two things. One is to say that you know it's Purim when you walk into shul and you smell bacon. So thank you, Toby. We're having a revised kosher policy for the month. And the topic is serious, and I want to dedicate it in a serious way, and then I want to be sure to smile with you. I've said that a few times over the last couple of days. And for those who have been paying attention to the news, it's a heavy week for the Jewish people all around the world. The attack in Jerusalem has really changed lives forever, and Adar for a lot of people, and the Mideast political scene in very serious ways. Hopefully it'll still move in a positive direction. And this is a month to have hope. And so hopefully we do. On a personal note, I also want to dedicate my teaching this morning to a student of mine who died. His name is Scott Silberman. And so I'm thinking about him a lot. He gave me a blue guitar that I played last night. And so making music and memory at the same time is part of what I think it is to live a mythic life, actually. Just a quick show of hands. This is not for guilt, but so that I know how much review I want to be doing, and I'll do it quickly no matter what. Who is here for the first session of Mythic Life? Okay, great. Now, for those who weren't, very brief, and if you'd like to talk to me about it afterwards, I'm glad to review. The word myth is a very difficult word, regardless of setting, but when it's about a faith tradition that you call home, it's even harder. That might be obvious to say, but to spell out why it might be difficult, I say the word myth, and many people say the word lie. They say lie. They say fabrication. Is it the air that I'm hearing? Yeah. Well, the fridge is quiet now, thank God, but now we're... It's the air. Okay. So I'll try to speak up. I want to make sure that everyone can hear. I say myth. Some people say lie. But I say mythic that deepens the proportion of the conversation. And for some people, that's comforting. And for some people, it's just as problematic. Both have a legitimate claim to their position. So what I'm proposing is not what I think anyone else needs to believe. I think this is one healthy, faith-infused, skeptical, hopeful way of looking at the world. But it need not be something that you feel imposed upon with. I'm not looking for anyone to agree with me necessarily, though it's always nice to see people nodding their heads. It's even nicer in a Jewish perspective to see people going, uh-uh. And then we have a very deep conversation regardless. So if you disagree, we're cool. Number two, the first conversation that we had was mythic time. And to say in one sentence or two what we said, or at least what I was trying to suggest, mythic time means that in any one moment, I don't exist only in that moment. Living a mythic life means that when I light candles, even if the candlesticks that we use in my family, in my home, are ones that I bought for my wife, I think of my mom lighting candles and the fact that her candlesticks were given to her by her grandmother. I'm not even looking at the same thing, and suddenly the ritual moment evokes multiple moments of my own life, even moments I didn't witness. I didn't suggest last time, and I'm going to use it as a segue. There's a great fiction novel by an author named Anne Ursu. If you haven't read her, she's very, very good. Her debut novel was called Spilling Clarence. Clarence is the name of a town, a fictional town, but it's just like many suburban towns. And it has a few different institutions in the town. One of them is a chemical plant. One of them is an assisted living home. One of them is a college. There's a Barnes & Noble type bookstore. Well, the chemical plant has a spill. Spilling Clarence. And from there comes a chemical, and you don't see what it does to you, but it has the effect of unlocking your memories. You can't hold back your memories anymore once you're exposed to the chemical. Now, if you can imagine the different institutions that I listed, it hits the assisted living community first because they've got the most memories. In fact, there's a charmer who lives in the assisted living facility who is one of the liberators at Dachau. And he goes into catatonic shock because he can't contain his memories. There's a man in town, he's sort of middle-aged, he just lost his wife the year before, and he won't leave his room because his memories are unlocked, and suddenly he's with his wife again. Time doesn't exist in a linear fashion when a mythic understanding of the world and yourself, and it all flows. And in many ways, that's an important way to think about space. So I'd like to begin with a question. Let's start Jewish and then get particular to the individual. So you tell me. I say mythic place in Jewish tradition. What comes out for you? Jerusalem, Gan Eden, right? Paradise. Sinai, the desert. There's a cave of the patriarchs, and the matriarch is called Marat HaMachpelah. It's in modern-day Hebron, which is also known by other names.
The Western Wall.
Mount Ararat. Masada, sure. Prozdor Lolam Haba, right? But that means this entire universe, which is a prozdor, which is the name, the word bullpen doesn't exactly work, but prozdor is the name of the hallway that leads to our Makom Tefillah, right, to where we daven. The whole world is seen as an antechamber to the world to come. In a second, I'm going to come back to that idea in a second.
Right here,
okay. You're jumping the gun. Anywhere else? Mashiach. Interesting. I said mythic place, and you said Mashiach, and I'm not disregarding it. I think that's right. Prozdor Lolam Haba. It's not so different. Antechamber to the world to come, and Messiah as either person or framework or place or dimension. I mean, these questions become more slippery. Once we get past what you see, categories fall apart. Steindl says that. I quoted a very difficult, almost unintelligible part of the 13-petaled rose in my presentation last time, where Steindl talked about the categories of time, space, and they fall apart once you get deeper.
What do you think of
Shemaim? Right? So Shemaim. Let's use that word. I wasn't planning on it, but it's a good one. Shemaim means?
Heaven.
Right. Sky, heaven. It also means Shamaim. There's water. And all right, so what does it mean? Shemaim, heavens. Heavens, sky. Heaven is above me. That means heaven's not right here. If that's where the angels dwell, angels are above me. If that's where God dwells, God doesn't dwell on this earth. God is a lot like, lahavdil, Zeus. And the question is, does God descend from heaven to earth? And what does that mean about an infinite expanse of holiness? In fact, I was going to reference, it's a great usage. This last week's parsha, we just closed the book of Shemot. It is fascinating to think of this past parsha in this frame. The command to build the Mishkan, the tabernacle, from God to Moshe says, "Tasuli mikdash v'shachanti b'tocham." Build me a tabernacle and I will exist in you. Right? By the way, if you ever think about the bracha that we say, "V'chayei olam nata b'tochenu," right, and the life of the universe I place inside you. Just incredible. Oh yeah. Chaye Olam, right. Eternity, not right. So Shemaim suggests that God is in a place more than somewhere else. Depending on the let me stay with Shemaim for a second, then Hamakom is a good place to go also. If we believe that the Mishkan was a place where God's voice emanated, that means that from the moment of the dedication of the Mishkan, the place where the first command to build the Mishkan is no longer where God's voice comes from. Where I once heard God's voice is no longer apportioned, at least, as the most intimate connection with God. I heard God's voice in the desert, but now I need a building. In fact, not to conflate, but to conflate. What does it mean to worship in a rented space? Called home. In fact, I've stood in that auditorium at the JCC. The floor is creaking just the right way. The bamboo that we stand on here, listen what it does. I know I'm here. I can't wear these shoes when we're davening or walk comfortably, but I know that this is a holy place. What does it mean to now own and be responsible for a building that becomes, or should be, and is, for me and many, mythic? What does it mean for a place to actually be owned? It means that the place that once held my connection with the divine in a primary way can still hold a connection with the divine, but isn't where I go for that sense of connection. Does that mean that God's presence now I'm using classic terminology, travels with me, with we. But then what about where I'm not? The ultimate way to understand this is actually quite trite. Would you bring a sidur into the bathroom? Why not? Is God not in the bathroom? And I'm being a little bit rhetorical. It's not that God isn't in the bathroom. It's that my understanding of God is that the connection is less appropriate in one place than it is in another. I once bought a book by Umberto Eco because I was looking for some bathroom reading. And I was thrilled. This new book, great. And I, you know, opened the book. And there on the first page is a list of the sefirot with God's name everywhere. So what does that mean? It means that ultimately there are places where I feel I shouldn't be connecting with God. Does that mean I believe God is less there? And I wouldn't say no so quickly. Yes. We do say a blessing in praise of functioning. It's called Asher Yasar. In fact, though, it's supposed to be said when you leave the bathroom. There's a discussion in the Gemara about a room called Beit HaKiseh, which means the throne room, and it means the bathroom. But that was a place where what we did stayed there. It's an outhouse in many ways, because plumbing wasn't invented during that time. And so the question is, well, something that emanates from my body, in a natural way, please God, thank God it works, it makes the place less appropriate for the God who allowed, you know, the conversation is very strange, because all of a sudden, place is delineated. There is a more intense or appropriate, or whatever word, kasher, experience of God in some places than in other. Now, if we were dealing with an earlier time, we would say, or from a different religious understanding, maybe not our faith tradition, we would actually be comfortable saying, no, God is not there. God is not with them. God's with us. I draw a circle and God's in it. Or in other words, I draw a box. And God is in a box. And the fact is that box is a certain amount of cubits that looks like the Mishkan. It looks like the tabernacle. It looks like the Western Wall. I have an ambivalent relationship with the Western Wall. I cry in it every time I go. My children have sort of kissed the wall with me, and that makes me cry more. And I will go back and cry again. There's a song about there are stones with the hearts of people and people with the hearts of stones. It's called Hakotel, the Western Wall. And my heart knows the song. But the problem is, I go there and people are bound to it also. What does it mean for God to be in a place? Right? God is in this place and I didn't know is a great quote from Yaakov. Right? Okay. I didn't know God was in this place. And then that's actually the word makom. So I'm just going to use one more word of introduction, then we'll jump into some text after some questions. So the one more word of introduction is the classic name of God in a moment of loss is makom, hamakom. The place. It can't be translated really, but makom means place. And I've learned from my teacher and friend and singing partner, David Paskin, a rabbi in Massachusetts, that who lost his own daughter before she turned two, and this album was very much a response of his that I learned a lot sharing. That, and I actually wrote this, I realized afterwards that I wrote this in the piece I sent out to the shul last week. When we say HaMakom Yenachem, that the place should comfort, what we're actually doing, strangely enough, is filling up the space with our words. When we visit a shiva house, the hardest thing to do is the first rule of a shiva house. Don't talk. The person who's in mourning speaks first. Which means we have to experience a space in an acutely painful way. That's HaMakom. The void should be a comfort to you. Because void is another way of saying space. If you've seen this is my first movie reference for the day, The Neverending Story, based on a German book by Michael Ende. Right? What is attacking this world of hope and fantasy? The nothing. To countenance the nothing. It's not empty, it's nothing. And that's a name of God. So what does it mean when we talk about mythic place and God? When God is known at moments of loss, the deepest, in many ways, the deepest human experience to have, as being the only place, or the nothing, I guess. The potentiality is a more positive way of saying that. chaos is another. And so Shemayim, to return to that, and then we'll jump in. Questions first. Shemayim, I look at this expanse, and I don't see anything. And if that's where God is, that's interesting. In fact, in the book of Shemot, it says that when the people, upon receiving the Torah, they looked up and they saw God's feet, and beneath God's feet the sky was as blue as sapphire. And I don't know what that means. But if Shemayim, which is the word there, Ketor Sapir, I think that's the phraseology, I'm probably misquoting a little bit, to see nothing means to recognize God's feet. There's a lot of teaching like that. But what's interesting is that they have to look to a place with nothing to get to some sort of mythic understanding. And we use words to describe it, but if we were in that raw moment, what would we see? We look to a place and I see the sky. Or maybe they saw something in a place, which meant that they couldn't look down to see that place. Okay, questions first and then we'll jump in. Jerry.
Hi.
Normally, have a sense of the presence of God.
Amen. Wow.
But there are places where I don't have working places. And one of those is a heiau in Hawaii. That's a religious place in Hawaii.
Huh.
There's this complete absence of the sensation. Now,
huh.
Sensation, sense of God, a sensation of feeling the presence of God. And what does the presence of God mean? And what does the being of God mean?
Hmm. Wow. For those who didn't hear, Jerry just said that he typically does feel the presence of God, and there are places, or maybe situations, where he does not. And one of them is called a heiau, is it? Which is a religious ceremony in a religious place in Hawaii. And so you said, what does it mean to not have a sense of God in a place? And what's fascinating then is perhaps the question, and I'm not sure, is God's presence dependent upon my sense of God?
Well,
is it possible to say that God has a presence outside of my own, outside of me?
But you have a relationship to God, that's one thing you're saying. And there's another thing where it's just the existence of God. Now, if I feel the presence of God, or say I don't feel the presence of God in this place,
yeah.
That may not mean that God isn't there. There may mean that. Anyway, that's the
thing. No, I think it's a valid. To say it's a valid question is also a little bit patronizing, but it's a very powerful question, which is to say, are there places where God's presence is presence is not? Laura, did you want to follow up?
I was thinking of the mythic place where we're going to go. Okay. I was thinking,
So, I don't want to go to this place yet. I really don't, actually. thinking of the heavens as a place that we will go, I just wanted to suggest. I wanted to suggest two books. One of them is a kid's book and is harder to read, and one is an adult book, which is one of the deepest books I think written to date that touches on the topic. Both of them are quote fiction. So the children's book is called The Next Place. I can't think of who the author is. It is a tremendously helpful and tear-jerking and hard book. I've used it many times working with children whose parents are dying. And one of the most intense experiences I've had was with a third grader named Amy, who we were reading the book together. And in fact, she was reading it every night with her mother and father. And it was very, very intense. One of the center pages, you can see, imagine it, the outsides of the page are light blue, and the inside of the page gets increasingly white. And she said, Rabbi, I can't look at this page. It hurts my eyes too much. Right? So I don't know. This is not really a response to what you said, but at least a conversation with. And that page says, I don't know what my family and friends will look like when I see them here, but I know I won't be alone. And that's a place. And the other one is called The World to Come by Dara Horn. If you haven't read Dara Horn, I really, this is the only thing I'll make as an imposition, because it's not the way I speak, but please read The World to Come by Dara Horn.
Horn.
H-O-R-N. Her debut novel was called In God's Image, or In the Image. In the Image. I always do that. But The World to Come is just this incredible, rapturous, difficult book, where in many ways the Jewish traditions about the world to come are spelled out, woven in the story. That the world to come might not be a place. In fact, there's a Kabbalistic notion that the world to come is right here and is built by what we do. Maimonides would say something similar, though he wasn't a Kabbalist in the least. Okay. Anybody else so far? Oh, Tina. Sorry. Is that my coffee? Yes, that'd be phenomenal. Thank you.
I'm just interested in how you describe the presence being in a void, and I'm wondering if, on some level, God is where we can't find Him, and that God leads us to look for Him, and that is, has to do with sense of a place of the times that we look for Him, like the times where we pray, and so it's a
good. For those who didn't hear Tina, and tell me if I misrepresent what you said at all. Tina was saying, the way I described as God in a void, perhaps it could be explained that God is where we don't sense God, and that might be what leads us to pray, which means that the place is more, I don't know if I understood what you meant, going towards time.
Well, that in a sense, the place is absent, and so it's the time that we pray to God abide.
So I would translate that and tell me if it works. That it's the, you said it's the times that we feel God's absence that creates the space. So it's not really space. When you say times, I want to make I want to actually phrase that as subjective experience of the world. That what's happening to me, the event. In many ways, when I say time, sometimes I think of a rhythm that is predetermined. And in fact, this is very much based on where I am, and where I am in a metaphysical way. This is what's happening to me in a moment where I am not feeling God, and that leads me to search, and my search is actually based on when I'm searching. That leads me to an encounter, which is not exactly a place. Okay. Yeah. No, It's similar to what Jerry was suggesting in some ways, in that the subjective experience that he brought, which wasn't his own personal moment, was one where he did not feel God's presence, and that caused him to wonder, and perhaps wonder is the way of invoking a connection with God again. It's not a, it wasn't a dark wondering, but it was, why isn't God here? And then that question, perhaps, is what triggers the place. I want to suggest that as not a response, but a synergistic comment with comment.
Talking about the Mishkan, and that it's, you know, that God resides in the Mishkan, and then recently I was reading about the construction of the temple, and as you go further and further and further in, you know, you get to the Holy of Holies where God was dwelling and the priests could only go in very briefly, and I started thinking about one's own body in that same way, and that opening up, you know, that center, that core of my own self, in order to allow in.
Good. For those who didn't hear Ellen, in half a second of rephrase, our own bodies are places. And so in the dimensions of the Mishkan, as they're spelled out, the tabernacle, as you get deeper and deeper, it's less and less accessible, but it's more and more holy, whatever that means. It has been suggested, and it's going to be in one of our texts, that the foundation stone called Evan Shtia was a meeting place. And the foundation stone is the way that the Muslim world also refers to this stone that we believe in legend is where Abraham almost sacrificed Isaac. It's in the Dome of the Rock. It's in the Holy of Holies. Some of us don't go. Some of us do go. It's one of those taboo places, which is also magnetic. The Evan Shtia is actually the heart of a person in the Kabbalistic text, which means that in order to encounter God most deeply, we need to get to our heart and expose it, pull back that curtain. And I think the combination of body and place, I mean, say my body's a temple. And actually, Art, when we made a memorial for Leonid, the song that came to mind that I shared then was a gospel song called, "O Lord, Please Make Me a Sanctuary." Right? I mean, it means that I want to be the dwelling place. Make me the place. Right? So, okay, let's jump in a little bit. Whoever said desert, thank you, when I asked for one mythic place, it is fascinating if we look at Jewish tradition to see how the time of the desert is represented. Right? Remember, let's just review for a second because we're there in the Torah. Right? Time in the desert. We've escaped Egypt. We're not yet at the promised land. We're hungry, we get manna. We're thirsty, we get from a rock. Who just said this? Aryeh said this. Aryeh ben David, who's a rabbi, Aryeh ben David, tremendous teacher. Beth Israel brought him in, and some of us got to sing and metaphysically sing too. And he suggested these things. During the desert, we got what we needed. Well, Shtiyah Lishtot, absolutely. Absolutely, right? The rock, not only of meeting, it's the rock from which we can drink. Right, we're thirsty, go to the rock. We want meat, we get quail coming out of our nostrils. Right? But what's really interesting about that is it's either really good, or if you look at the way God gives in to our, quote, request, our kvetch, for meat, and I'm saying that in this shul, we'll get a barbecue one day. God says, you want meat? I'll give you meat so much it'll come out your nostrils. Right, it doesn't sound all that pleasant. So let's look at these two texts. On the page that has all the texts in front of you, right, text 1 and 2. One is from Jeremiah 2:2, and one is from Psalms chapter 95. We say that chapter of Psalms every Erev Shabbat, part of Kabbalah Shabbat. It goes, Arba'im Shana Akut Gedor. So here's the first one. This is Jeremiah. Go and cry in the ears of Jerusalem. Right, Jeremiah witnesses the first exile, saying, thus says the Lord, I remember you. And we do this High Holidays. If you know Zacharti Lach, Chesed Neuraiah, these are the words. It's really, yeah, we should just sing. This is good learning. We should just sing. We will. Thus says God, I remember you, the devotion of your youth, your love like a bride, when you followed after me in the wilderness in a land that was not sown. Right? It was love. The honeymoon. I mean, here's the other one. For 40 years, I was provoked by that generation. I thought, they're a senseless people. They would not know my ways. And I swore in anger, they shall never come to my resting place. So let's talk about the desert. What's the desert? It's a place. What happens in the place? What does it mean? Which text? Right? Is it a honeymoon? Is it not? In fact, one of the punchlines, which I think is obvious, is that a holy place isn't one thing. I mean, we know that. Anyone who goes to shul knows that it's a lot of things to a lot of people, and sometimes it's nothing to someone, but they show up anyway. Which means it's a thing. It means something. Some people go to one room more than other rooms. Some people like to hang out in the kitchen. Some people, and they're usually short, like the playground a lot more than any other room. And that's going to shul. Why? What does it represent? It's the same place that they get kicked in the head on the monkey bars. But they still want to go to shul. What is it? So I want to hold the question open. But the desert is not one thing. In fact, if we look historically, if we look at the Torah's telling of the story, right, everybody who got there died before they got where they wanted to go. You could say, you know, making it metaphoric, that it's the liminal space. Liminal meaning not here, not there. We were on the journey, and in fact, the children born in the desert, which are the only ones that made it to Eretz Yisrael, with the exception of Yehoshua, Caleb we don't know about. In fact, it's a different conversation, but Yehoshua and Caleb are very strange. As are we, so I guess we could talk with them. At least I am. The children born into the desert were born into a state of not knowing. They were born into this liminal space. They don't know what they're supposed to be yet. They have this weird understanding, yeah, my parents experienced destruction. In fact, it sounds a little bit like me trying to say anything about the Holocaust. Lahavdil. What can I say with a real understanding? It's part of my mythic understanding of self. I'm never going to get out of that. Now, I visited Poland, but what do I know? What do I know? Nothing. But I know. And, you know, a place is a very strange thing to think you're distant from when you're always there.
It's a crucible. You go into the bazaar and you're one thing and you can't come out of it, that same thing.
Good. That last line. Lam just said, you can't go into the midbar, into the desert, as one thing and emerge as that same thing. You're my segue. Thank you. Turn over the page for a second. This is the best Jewish text there is. It's from a play called Into the Woods. If you're familiar with it, great. If not, that and Darahorn. And Torah. It's all Torah. Into the Woods, Giants in the Sky, the premise of the play, Into the Woods, is very much that fairy tale characters interact. Their worlds collide, and you see their yearnings for happily ever after turn into a real life, not so happy ever after. And what does it mean? It's a fascinating play, and really tremendously powerful to see. I don't know if there's a production happening here, but it's always being revived, and I hope I get to see it again soon. This is a powerful one that Jack, climbing the beanstalk, or actually having climbed down, tells a story. So if you know the middle, there are giants in the sky. It's just really very cool. So look at the beginning. When you're way up high and you look below and the world you left and the things you know, little more than a glance is enough to show you just how small you are. Before you got there, you didn't know you were that small. In fact, you thought you could climb the beanstalk. You didn't know there were giants in the sky. Right? And all of a sudden, keep going. When you're way up high and you're on your own in a world like none that you've ever known, where the sky is lead and the earth is stone, the sky is lead? Like it's solid. I can walk on the cloud. You're free to do whatever pleases you. So there's a giant, but what does she do? The bottom paragraph on the left. A big, tall, terrible giant at the door. I have to sing it. It's hard not to. A big, tall, terrible lady giant sweeping the floor. What does she do? She's terrible, but she gives you food and she gives you rest. And she draws you close to her giant breast, and you know things now that you never knew before. Not till the sky. And he talked about being transformed. Little Red Riding Hood talked about going through the woods, veering off the path, and I know things now that I didn't know before. All of a sudden, I know a whole lot more. Why does she know more? Because she met a wolf. And she realized that she wanted to know the wolf. And it sometimes gets very sexual with many, many of these songs. But it's powerful to think that all of a sudden, what I thought I knew, I don't know. How did I learn that? By going somewhere strange that I've never been before. Another way of saying that is a desert. Another way of saying that is an unsown land. Right? What does it mean to go through this place? And imagine what it is to be born, not up and not down. You're born into this liminal space. I'm born into not knowing who I'm going to be. In fact, for many kids born today, in a post-9/11 world, in a post-modern world, in a world of deconstruction and absolute value just lost, and many of us become children again because of this world, and many of us never get to be children because of this world, we all don't know what we're supposed to become because we're encountering a place. So then the question might become, what does the word God mean? And God is in the place, but I don't know who I am in the place, and if part of knowing God is me knowing me, how can I get to God? I can't even get to me. And maybe it's the same journey. Art Green, who we're going to quote in a second, talks about the difference between verticality, that God is up and I am down, Shamayim in many ways, a classic sense, and internality. Ben-David talked about this last night too, although he was pointing that way in terms of relationship. Art Green says, in order to know God, I don't only look up, like a Catholic church would have me look, right? I look up and out, and that's where the light is coming in, and I'm pretty small. To know God, according to Green, I have to do an internal journey. I have to go in. Right? We're just talking about Art Green. This is ultimately, I think, a challenge to a classic Jewish notion. I think it's actually getting to the root of what Torah teaches, of what Judaism teaches, but many of us think about reaching out to God. But that's not bad. I mean, in fact, to say it's good is also to forget that it's natural and right. I lift up my eyes to the heaven. Where will my help come from? I'm looking to the heavens. I'm looking to the hills. Give me some help. Because who doesn't need help? But when you say, my help comes from God, creator of heaven and earth, one of the things that does is it tells me, I didn't create heaven and earth. I can't help myself. And I don't know about that. I know I didn't create heaven and earth. But I don't know that I can't. I don't know that I'm not able to help myself. That the other images of God around me are actually sharing in that image-ness. And that the place I need to look for help is actually not a hill. But to say I don't look to a place is also very strange. So this is really a great play. Talking about getting to the root, I'm looking at this bacon, I really can't get over it. I know it's bacon, but it still feels, yeah.
I have kind of come to see that as the unexplored place within myself.
Yeah.
That's where Moshe goes at the Council of the Burning Bush.
Good.
And that's where people need to kind of spend some time.
Yes.
In order to be able to move forward and embrace the land that we have.
One of the, tell me again if I'm missing what you just said, but Jay just said that he's come to see Midbar, desert, is actually an internal place that the children of Israel in the story need to get to in order to go, and so do we, an unexplored place that we need to investigate. In fact, by the way, to cut to a little bit of a chase, and if you don't have to, but I listed my blog on the top right of the page. I put up three links. That if you're interested for further exploration, there's a piece by the former chancellor of JTS, whose name is Ismar Shorsh, about the transition from the word midbar, which has the root devir, and the root davar. Devir is another word for the Holy of Holies. It's also the name of a printing press founded by Bialik in Israel and Tel Aviv. And from devir, a place that we would go, well, we lost the place a whole bunch of times over. So what we transitioned to was a davar, a word. A wonderful davar char that happened in my sukkah this past year. No, it wasn't C. Freeman. Please God, may he visit sometime soon. No, it was a rabbi from Sweden. That's right, thank you. So he said that last time he visited Berkeley was a very long time ago, and he felt Jewishly that he couldn't connect yet. It was a midbar to him, but the midbar became midaber, that it started speaking, that there were words being shared, that people were connecting in ways that he hadn't experienced. It might have been 35 years before. I don't know how long it had been in his journey. But the question of moving a place into a metaphor is both, I think, healthy, especially for diaspora people, for dispersed people, but is also problematic when we retain a place. What's the need for a place if I am the place? And that's actually one of the challenges I think we as a community feel also. When we talk about Israel, it's so laden with different valences that we forget sometimes that it is a place that is connected to not only being a place, and the political ramifications of taking the metaphysical value of home and then having to deal with politics and reality and history, well, it's very hard to hold on to both at the same time because it's a place, it's deeper than a place, it's more problematic because it's a place. All of these questions come to the fore, but to imagine that we've lost the need for a physical place, some would call it an irmiklat, right, a city of refuge. Some would call it dangerous to have a polity based on a faith tradition. We see what happens in the world because of that. Those questions are real because the place is real. Even though the Midbar is a mythic place, even, you know, what was Sharm el-Sheikh, what is Sharm el-Sheikh, what was Yamit, right, this during the return of the Sinai to Egypt, right, it wasn't an unsown land even though it was a desert. It's a resort that we were talking about. But it's a resort that became home. And the pulling out from Gaza was reminiscent in many ways for people pulling out from Yamit, because all of a sudden the place that became ours, whatever that means, we lost. all of a sudden the ground mattered. So even though it's possible to get metaphoric, and it's not wrong to, in fact, I think an exploration of the self is so appropriate with these terms, there are places that, at least for the Jewish people as a whole, matter because they're located. It's very hard, because ultimately if we don't do that, and this is one of the reasons that I love Israel so much, if we don't do that, we're ultimately alone as individual communities. I know, because I'm on Orthodox listservs, Reform listservs, Renewal listservs, Independent listservs, Activist listservs, Marriage Equality with a Heavy Jewish Bent listservs, all these different listservs, that everyone was abuzz, even though the yeshiva that was attacked on Thursday was a place that none of us would go. I'd never go to learn there. It's a type of Judaism that is not me. But I've got a distant cousin who does learn in that yeshiva. And I have a brother-in-law who studies in yeshiva, even less a place I would go. But all of a sudden, the whole world connected to its own, and I'm going to get to the text, and then I know that I opened up a can of worms, which I'm glad to keep on talking about. All of a sudden, I feel pain. Where? Text 2. As the navel is in the middle of the person, so is Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel. I love this word, it's Greek. The umphalos, the navel, the belly button of the world, as it is written in Ezekiel, that dwell in the navel of the earth. So what does that mean? Eretz Yisrael is located in the center of the world, Jerusalem in the center of Eretz Yisrael, the temple in the center of Jerusalem, the Heichal, the sanctuary, the Devir, the Holy of Holies, in the center of the temple, the Ark, in the center of the Heichal, and in front of the Heichal is the Eben Shtiyah, this foundation stone, this quenching stone. Actually, I'm going to start using it wrong. That's cool. From which the world was founded. My umbilical place hurt on Thursday. This wasn't a political pain that I felt. Oh, I wish my idea were not being damaged in the world. And it's not, oh, those people died, in the same way that I mourn for whenever there's a headline where someone dies or I hear that someone died. The difference is, this was my umbilical cord being yanked to a place. Now, the place is inside of me, too, but it's a place. David's not here this time, so I can't say that it's been... You know, I say things about the design of the shul sometimes, and he's always there, and I realize that I should have asked him before I said anything. I imagine we face east for a reason. We could, light is good too, you know. But we face east. Why? What's interesting, by the way, however, in the transition between physical place and a portable homeland, as many people call the Torah, is that if you are building a shul, you are obligated to build it facing east. If you can't, I don't know what that means, or you move into a space that's already built and that orientation doesn't work, you face wherever the Torah is. In fact, we do that. It's fact about we have three Torahs. It's kind of hard to figure out which angle to face as they were moving. But we follow the Torah, and suddenly east is not where we face. Our homeland has become embodied in a scroll, which is itself problematic when we analyze it, but they both mean home, as is looking in. Hi. So this question is incredibly powerful because the Torah is my umbilical cord too. I have an umbilical cord. I have a belly button. But the navel of the universe, at least from a Jewish framework, well, that's kind of compelling to me in the infancy. I can't escape and wouldn't. Well, forget wouldn't. I can't. It's biological in a certain sense, even though it's probably nurture.
But how do you say east?
I say east, kedma. Yeah, but kedma doesn't mean in, it means forward. Or else it means early, earliest. Okay, you're good. We should talk before I start teaching. So, there are a lot of questions that we can deal with, and there are a lot of texts. I wanted to suggest something about sacred space based on someone who, in his early days of scholarship, was a friend of the Jews and was a little bit, not as much when he got older. Moshe Eliade was a professor at the University of Chicago, and his work on comparative religion was incredibly profound. He dealt with the creation of sacred space and the things that connect. not so different from Joseph Campbell, who also was not exactly a friend of the Jews, but had a lot of positive impact on a Jewish understanding of the world. There's a phrase called Axis Mundi. Axis Mundi means the axis around which the world revolves. And every tradition, even a personal tradition, has those places. Right? Superman, there you go, had the Fortress of Solitude, but he also had a telephone booth. Both places let him be him. Batman's Batcave happened to be under his home. Now, do I know whether or not the, you know, Stan Lee and whoever else... Stan Lee do Batman too? No, it's DC. Oh, whatever. Spider-Man doesn't have a place. Fascinating. He has a lab. He doesn't even have a place. I was thinking about him, actually. Ultimately, what does it mean to need to go to a place to be more yourself? I've quoted this before, by the way. Leon Wheels here says in his book, Kaddish, and he hated davening, and he hated tefillin, and he hated all this, but he started to do it when his father died. He woke up in a cold sweat 3 months into the 11 months. He woke up in a cold sweat at some conference in D.C., and he said, I needed to go somewhere because I needed to tie myself to myself with my tefillin. He wasn't home, but suddenly wherever he was going to go, it was going to be home for him right then, and he needed it.
That's what you're saying before, though, they have the place, and
yeah.
You, but you go into it also.
Well, right, but Ram, what you're saying, however, this is the first time I disagree with you, that's not bad, like one for four. Shechanti b'tocham means I, God, will dwell with you, and it's in the plural, that's important too, but it could mean that the midbar becomes totally existential. The place becomes totally inside me. And the fact that wasn't good enough for Weasel Tear in that moment, he needed something beyond himself. He needed an external call. He needed a place. He needed somewhere to go. Now, yes, it was somewhere inside that he needed to go. But he needed to go to a place that he didn't define. In fact, I think that's one of the things that religious institutions do right. By creating a combined vision for a place, what this shul has become is recognizable to many different vision places. Many different people see parts of this building as a call. And what's really interesting is that even those who continue to give incredibly generously to keep this place alive and healthy and thriving, right, in order to see themselves, they look right through themselves. This is one of the most fascinating things I've ever seen in a shul, because it's not about being limited by the gift. The gift is what enables us to see clearly. It's powerful and fits very much with, I think, the integrity of the shul as a place. Right? Same thing about the sanctuary. The colors are interesting. The sound is interesting. The seats are interesting. They're movable. That's interesting. There's nowhere you go up. That's good. Right? But to different people, that means different things. But it's a place. Because I can get to that idea sometimes alone. I can go to a forest and weep. Right? I can be looking at an internet screen and be blinded by my own tears. I can pick up a guitar no matter where I am because the boy that I was talking about before gave me that guitar. Right? And I'm right there. But it's not enough all the time. In fact, it's mostly when I feel the absence, I need to go somewhere. I remember my first month here, I had this really tough day. And I walked right back into the sanctuary, right through the prose door. Didn't start using that word, just to brand it. And I opened the prose door, I walked in, I said, oh, this is the prose door. Before I walk in, let me just think. And I walked right in, and I said the bracha that ends with Hamechim Mitzadeh Gaver, God who prepares the steps of people. And I was right where I was supposed to be. And I really don't think I could have gotten there, not as easily, not as well, not as deeply, if there hadn't been a place defining my safety. So the desert is a place that doesn't define safety unless we think it's a honeymoon. But if you've, you know, in real relationships, the honeymoon is not the whole relationship. And even the honeymoon has moments of, you know, grating on each other. Sometimes. Maybe, you know, just hypothetically speaking. Right? Because even, it's not the first time you've met, and you know each other's idiosyncrasies, and, you know, there's going to be a moment where it's not, you know, you gave me everything I needed and still got you. Those are great. Oh my God, it's forever. By the way, if there's a relationship with God to be detailed in the desert, it was the unknown eternal commitment being made at Sinai. Right? And the metaphor for that moment is incredibly powerful because both is a place. Of course, we don't know where the place is, but some have been there anyway. And I've said this before, that mountain, right, it says in the Torah, they stood b'tachtit ahar. And it means, at least in some translations, all of B'nai Israel camped out at the bottom of the mountain. But in the Gemara, it says that God took the mountain, flipped it on its head, it was like an inverted cask, and said, and held it over our heads and said, do you accept the Torah? If yes, good. If not, this will be your grave. That place means a lot of things. And then the Kabbalists said, that's awful. Even the Gemara, the next line, says, that's awful. That's a relationship based on coercion.
Yeah.
We're going to be talking about that next Shabbat, by the way. And so the Kabbalists said, yes, God held the Torah above their heads, but it was a chuppah. It was a scary moment of entering a relationship, but it was not one of threat. But it's a place. It's not just a place, it's a relationship, but it's based in a locatable, in this place. Sorry.
Yeah. So if we can dive up a little further to kind of help explore the concept you're saying, the question today, one of the things that I'm kind of hearing in authority, you know, when you come back to this metaphor, the traditional God of Zeus, it really helps me kind of define a traditional vertical God as almost a kind of idolatry in a way. It's helpful for me when you make it an analog to Zeus, because it shakes me out of my traditional way of thinking of God that I've been schooled in. And when you talk about desert, it instinctively for me is just like a dimension of why. But I immediately don't think of it as something external or even historical, but something that is within me. And when Rabbi Kula writes about this pathless times, like when the Jesus human first killed her, we got lost in our lives, that we're right back in the desert, the guys are gone. It's very clear that it's not something that's external, and it breaks down all those artificial boundaries. So for me, that's kind of a helpful crossing the dimensions of God in place. It shakes me out of thinking of God and how my own has nothing external to me. And as you say something, I can look within and find. And my sense is that's part of where you're going. We're trying to impart that it's not an external, you know, there are external symbols of it, but it's something that we can carry around inside, something that's within, that's within our community. Does that sound like it's in some of the things you're trying to describe?
Very much so. In fact, leading up to that is, right, because that sounds like a homecoming to use a different word. And in fact, in order to come home, we need to not be there. So what I wanted to make sure that I said at least once, and this is obviously a conversation we can't complete, what I wanted to make sure we said once is based on two texts on your page, text 4 and text 5. Right? Moses' sons are fascinating because you only hear about them once. And then they reunite with Moshe, and then you never hear about them again, except that one of them ends up being involved in bad stuff when he gets older with his family, and part of it is because Moses never went home. And that's something I think about all the time, as a rabbi's kid and now as rabbi with kids. So, Gershom is one of the names of Moses' kids. Gershom means a stranger there. For those who don't know, there's a prayer you say when you hear a siren. It comes from Numbers chapter 12. It's El Na Rafan Allah. Please, God, be there for them. It's originally said by Moses to Miriam, but I think I said this before, but being in a place where the sacred space interacts with the world, either through sound, through vision, it's actually a good way to make sure that staying grounded doesn't mean becoming isolated, isolationist. So, okay. Gershom is the name of Moses' son. Remember, Moses started off with his family, becomes the Nile swimmer at an early age, grows up in the palace, kills an Egyptian, leaves, goes somewhere else, experiences God, comes back, but he's no longer he's not Pharaoh's child or Pharaoh's grandchild. He's also not accepted as family by the Israelites at first. He knows alienation. It's not being at home. So Steve Israel, who works for the Jewish Agency in Israel, wrote, what sort of a father would call his own son stranger? If Moses indeed did call his own son stranger, it is clear that he wanted to pass over his own feeling of cultural alienation in Egypt and in Midian to his child. He wanted Gershom to grow up with the same kind of cultural alienation that Moses himself had experienced through much of his life in two different societies. Moses must have planned the moment when many years in the future, Gershom would turn round with a question, because he, the father, would have the answer ready involving an explanation of Gershom's and Moses' real cultural identity. Moses clearly meant to pass on to his son the feeling of exile, the feeling of not belonging. Why? Because it would bring him home. Aviva Zornberg says that very clearly in one line, that's text 5, in another Greek book that's very hard to read. The journey commanded by God to Avram, lech lecha, go, leave, is a divine imperative that articulates and emphasizes displacement as its crucial experience. Right? In order for, just speaking personally, in order to end up in Berkeley, which I never thought that I would do in my life, I had to feel like I was in the wrong place when I was where I thought home was supposed to be. In English, I came to a place I never imagined would be home because the place I thought was home wasn't. That's not to vilify Boston. It's to say that, wow, I didn't know that my umbilical cord went west too. Because, you know, when relationship works, you know. And that's fascinating. In order to come home, you have to not be home. In order to grow into the adult who ends up going in, you have to cut the umbilical cord. Individuation separation is one of the hardest stages as an early parent, as an older parent, who I don't know yet. But letting go so that the child can self-determine, self-differentiate, become self, explore their own Evenstia, which is not you. I mean, probably a mother has a harder time than a father because I've never had a physical connection. I'm in fact deeply jealous of that, in some ways. In many metaphysical ways. But ultimately, what does it mean to need a place? What is that place? Well, in that last sentence, place is mother. As growing person, that place is home. But what is home? I go to New York sometimes, and I'm driving on the Henry Hudson Parkway, which is also now the Joe DiMaggio Expressway. It was renamed only for like 5 blocks. But it's a nice 5 blocks. And I, even if I'm going all the way downtown to the village, I end up getting off at 125th Street so I can drive by JTS at 122nd and Broadway. Not only because I spent 11 years of my life learning there, but I was born there. My parents were there when I was born. It's been part of my sense of self. Home is very strange because even the face looks different. They redeveloped the whole thing. And then I had to rediscover home because it wasn't my parents' home that I was learning in. It became mine. Well, so I have a couple of axis, axi mundi, if I just did that right, places around which the world revolves. I have Berkeley because this is my home. I have Jerusalem because that's my home. I have Virginia, even though I never lived there, my parents do. The world teeters on so many strange things, sort of like a gyroscope that you played with as a kid. You pull the string and it keeps on spinning, and you see it tottering like this, but it never sort of loses its grounding because it knows how to keep on turning so it can stay still. So one last word, and then I'll take a couple of comments and then be done. But I'm really thrilled to think out loud with all of you. And I'm hoping when I listen to this, I think I said something clear. What creating sacred space, God bless you, should do is it creates order out of chaos. It gives a place where you can hear God's voice above the rushing waves. By the way, there's a great book called God's Voice from the Void by Shaul Magid. It's an exploration of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. So it's a very hard book, but a very, very good book. I thought of it when you... Shaul Magid, M-A-G-I-D. Bless you. If sacred space is that which creates order out of chaos, what does it mean within sacred space to shatter the categories that give us structure? To say that time and space don't actually exist in the way that we understand them when we're living in a mythic dimension means that when you come into the place that purports to give you shelter from a swirling chaos, as typical religious structures will say, we don't, but as typical religious structures say, we create safe space so that the darkness around is combated by the light from within. That sounds kind of religious. I don't say that kind of thing. I don't think that kind of thing. But that's at least in an earlier understanding what a religious home was supposed to do. By saying that you enter here and categories fall apart means you enter and there's chaos. That's, and we're going to get to this in a later conversation. I'm using this as a diving board segue that we will explore later. That's ultimately one of the reasons I think ritual is very important. Because if time doesn't exist in a linear fashion, and space is actually existential at its deepest, you walk into a place that uses that terminology, you don't know where or when you are. But the fact that we come regularly and look each other in the eyes means that when we get to the place that allows chaos to flow a little bit more flowy, there's someone right next to you who's rooting you in your seat. You're not alone. Even if you don't know when you are because you're lost in your memories, they spill out. Even if the personal journey, this existential, who am I, what am I, let me get to that depth of myself, I'm really thirsty for this understanding. Even if we're lost physically and you end up in a shul, hopefully other places too, all of a sudden the world that doesn't make sense continues to not make sense, but we're a little bit more okay. Because there's something expectable. There's something that we intentionally regiment in our lives to do. In fact, there are moments where I am so tired at 3 p.m. that I walk down the block to the bread workshop to get a coffee, the French roast. Very, very good. And all of a sudden, the fact that I know that I do it at 3 o'clock, and I actually know the names of the servers, and we talk for half a second, it doesn't change drastic things to the outside observer, but all of a sudden, I can come back to the place that I'm expected to be with energy, because that was there too. When the bread workshop changed their Friday morning hours, which they did, all of a sudden I define a new ritual. And I know that doesn't sound like putting on tefillin, or opening up a siddur, or keeping kosher at the bread workshop, but it means the exact same thing to me. It means that in the moments that swirl, I have something I can do. I understand something. I can hold on to something. I have a blessing to say in our sanctuary when I'm having a hard day. I have Torahs to face when we're trying to coordinate a 3-Torah day. But the Torah is what I'm facing, so coordinating it means I'm holding on to a lifeline even as I'm swimming and floundering just a little bit. We have a class on Sunday morning, and we have davening before it so that we can meet each other and be together. That's no less sublime than kissing a stone at a wall. But the question of place is incredibly profound because it's all interwoven when it works. So I thank you. And I'd love to, if there are things aching, I know I went a little bit over time, so maybe I'll take like 2 if people want to, and then I won't go anywhere quickly.
Your place seems to have people.
My place does seem to have people. The tree falling in the forest doesn't happen if we weren't there. I think reality is very much experience. John Dewey said differently worded similar things, I think.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, I won't take too much time to do my story of how I was separated from God and people and everything. When I thought everything lost its soul, you haven't used the word soul or spirit. And to me, somehow, places have a soul and a spirit tied in with the story. I just wonder, is that part of it? Is the soul idea or the spirit any part of this? I mean, I can talk a lot about it, but I want to hear what you say.
No. You know, Sheldon's question is, I think, really on target. There's a science fiction Mormon theology infused book called Stranger in a Strange Land. I thought so. By Heinlein. And there's an interesting moment where the group that gets together, which isn't clearly a religion but isn't clearly not, because they're suggesting something so radical, has their nest, their temple, destroyed. And so someone comforts the founder and says, aren't you sad? Aren't you upset? And he says, no, it was chock full of memories. It was time to find a new place. And one of the questions that I have in my own exploration of this question is, does a place have its own soul? When I say that the temple's remnant, the wall, has stones that have heartbeats, I'm suggesting that. But I also fight the impulse to allow anything that is a thing to be intrinsically holy, because that sounds a whole lot like idol worship to me. And so the soul of the world, Kabbalah says, the soul of the world is actually dressed layer into layer into layer. And the way it, and I'm planning a course like this next year sometime. We'll see if Art lets me back. Where an exploration of the Kabbalistic notion of layers is discussed. Because ultimately, in a classic Kabbalistic way, Shi'ur Koma, which means both the dimensions of God and the framework of a human body, is the most problematic and seductive part of mysticism. Because it means that I am the soul, I individually, you individually, are the soul of the universe. And it means, yeah, everything is intrinsically holy because you are. And in fact, in layers, God is neither the beginning nor the end. God is woven into almost every layer. And the deeper you get, the closer to God you get. But what's interesting is, once you get to your deepest place, which is that Eben Shtia, I know I'm going off a little bit, which is also God's essence, kivyachol, as if I could say something like that, leads you right back to God's chair, whatever that means, which is resting upon us. So in order to get in, I have to go in, which leads me out, and I'm back in, and then I'm out. And all of that is interwoven with God's soul, which is another way of saying everything is permeated with the divine. And once I say that something has a soul, I'm saying God permeates that space more than another. To give a thing life is, at least to my understanding of the world, akin to idol worship, because then God is more in the thing than not. In a human body, I'm more comfortable saying things like that, but of course it becomes just a little bit idolatrous in terms of what it is to be a human being as well. So I want to, we'll keep talking, Sheldon, but I want to be able to make one point, pull it together, and then I'll walk over to you so we can keep on talking. But one of the questions I have, a lingering question, is what does it mean to talk about mythic something? Because we've so far talked about time and place. Place is a little bit more identifiable, even if it can be used in a metaphoric sense. It's a place, it's a thing. And to say that it's tinged with holiness suggests that other things are not. It suggests it. I'm uncomfortable with that suggestion. But the creation of a place that allows you to connect is different than the creation of a place that then becomes its own soul. Without this community, this building would be a shell. I'm very comfortable saying that. Right. And without this building and this community, this place would be a liquor store. And without the liquor, that would be a shell. So it's an important continuing conversation, and I'm really glad to have had it. Boker Tov, everybody.